It is Monday, November the 26th. This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, tense times along the U.S.-Mexico border.
Certainly something that we're not used to seeing, especially given the highly politicized nature of both the recent caravans as well as immigration.
Ukraine saying that Russia seized its ships plus protesters on the streets of Paris.
What they're particularly upset about is that French President Emmanuel Macron has brought in new taxes that will be levied on diesel fuel at the pump.
Also ahead, something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. officials temporarily closed traffic at the border with Mexico Sunday, south of the city of San Diego, California, prompting an intense situation among Central American migrants seeking asylum here in the U.S. Reuters' Nathan Frandino reporting.
Chaos and confusion swelled at the U.S.-Mexico border on Sunday as U.S. officials halted all border traffic between San Diego and Tijuana. The closure came as Mexican police cracked down on a protest on behalf of Central American migrants massed near the port of entry, while U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers on the U.S. side fired tear gas. Protesters were caught in the middle. Many of the migrants are part of a caravan seeking asylum in the United States. Last month, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the deployment of military forces to the border to help stop the migrants from crossing into the U.S. Sunday's confrontation sent protesters running in different directions. Some say they intended to cross the border. Others were seen running through a canal near the crossing point. The activity came a day after Trump said migrants would stay in Mexico until their asylum claims were individually approved in U.S. courts. Mexico's incoming government has denied they had struck any such deal.
For some insight into all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Mark Jones, the chair of the Latin American Studies Program at the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University, asking him what happened in San Ysidro Sunday. Well, was it extraordinary?
It's certainly something that we're not used to seeing, especially given the highly politicized nature of both the recent caravans as well as immigration after the midterms. It also reflects, I think, growing frustration among both the migrants, but also among many on the U.S. side and in Mexico about the state of the situation. And I think it's going to probably also lead to a need by the Mexican government to react, because now with the closing of the San Ysidro crossing, the groups that are going to suffer the most are going to be Mexicans residing in Tijuana, whose ability to travel to San Diego for work as well as to have shoppers come from San Diego to Tijuana will be severely affected.
Tijuana's mayor on Friday declared a humanitarian crisis in his city.
Right, and that's essentially trying to get both federal money to come in. I think what we're likely to see is a growing negotiation between the Trump administration and that of the incoming Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, to provide what they essentially is going to be an antechamber for asylum claims, whereby Hondurans, Guatemalans and Salvadorans who are going to be claiming asylum will be required to wait all across the Mexican border until their case is essentially decided. I would assume that with that, the United States is going to provide some substantial funding in terms of housing, feeding, and caring for those migrants while they're waiting in Tijuana or across the Texas border in places like Matamoros and Nuevo Laredo and Ciudad Juarez.
President has indicated he's prepared to shut the entire border. But I understand this is not unprecedented. This has happened before.
Shutting the border can be done, but only on very rare circumstances, and it has an overwhelmingly negative impact on the economy. Any shutdown that lasts longer will have a very serious effect on both border workers, people who work on both sides of the border, but also on trade, because we're running on very narrow supply chains, and much of what our factories use here in the United States requires products that are coming from Mexico with a very narrow time frame for it to reach the factories. Otherwise, the factories need to shut down production.
The Washington Post on Saturday reported the Trump administration gained the support of Mexico's incoming government for a plan to require the asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for their applications to be processed. But the incoming administration denied any agreement was yet final.
I think they're negotiating it right now. What the López Obrador administration is going to try to do is extract the maximum it can from the Trump administration, because they realize that providing this remain in Mexico option for asylum seekers and keeping them there as opposed to in the United States, it resolves Donald Trump's major dilemma in that if people cross the border and request asylum, the government has really no choice but to effectively release them. And there's a great concern that they then will work illegally and then also just never appear for their final court hearing, in which case they'll add to the ranks of the more than 10 million undocumented immigrants that we have in the United States. So effectively, this remain in Mexico alternative would be a real boon for Donald Trump. And I'm sure Andres Manuel López Obrador is going to extract all he can from the president in terms of concessions before agreeing to it.
This caravan, by various figures, roughly estimates in size about 5,000. They reached Tijuana, which is a border city, over the past week after an exhausting trip of some 4,000 kilometers over a period of a month. Will the outcome of this situation be watched closely by other potential caravans?
I think it will, and that one of the things that the Trump administration is trying to do is to reduce the incentives for other people to travel from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala by indicating that if they arrive, they may not be allowed to cross into the United States and may be required to stay in Mexico for up to 2 years while their asylum case is being considered.
Is anybody behind these caravans, or are they just impromptu people just get together and decide to move north?
The original caravan that was the one that Donald Trump focused on was organized by some left-wing opponents of Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. Although these caravans do form relatively regularly, usually through the cooperation of groups that effectively are paid to transit immigrants across the Honduran and Guatemalan borders into Mexico and then across the Mexican border into the United States.
Would the cutting off of aid to these countries like Honduras and El Salvador prompt them to take action, or is new aid going to be required?
Well, it's not. The difficulty is that both the Honduran government and the El Salvadoran government have only tenuous control over their country, so there really isn't that much they can do. Threatening them with reduction of aid isn't going to change their ability to reduce our efforts in terms of reducing people coming from their countries. They simply are relatively weak states that don't have the capacity to limit where their citizens go or do not go. The reality is one of the major reasons why people from Honduras and El Salvador are making this perilous trip across Mexico is because of the overwhelming dominance of gangs such as Mara Salvatrucha 13 and Barrio 18, who effectively control large areas of both Honduras and El Salvador. If the government can't control areas of their country, their ability to keep criminal gangs from effectively controlling major swaths of territory, it's unlikely that they can do much to restrict migration.
Mark Jones is the Joseph Jamail Chair in Latin American Studies at the Baker Institute for Public Policy, all of that at Rice University in Houston. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Ukraine has accused Moscow of illegally seizing three of its naval ships off Russian-annexed Crimea after opening fire on them, a charge that, if confirmed, analysts are saying, could ignite a dangerous new crisis between the two countries. We asked Robert Manning, a senior fellow at the Scowcroft Center for Strategy, that is, and Security at the Atlantic Council, if this is Russia flexing its muscles.
I think they're turning it up a notch, for sure. Again, we don't know all the details in terms of international law for freedom of innocent passage and so on, and whether or not Ukraine violated that or not. But it's clearly an escalation, and the fighting in Ukraine has sort of fallen off the front pages, but the conflict has continued, and I don't know that we're any closer to a resolution. And this may, I don't know how many more sanctions we have to go on Russia. It's also been revealed recently, Washington Post story today that there's an elaborate bypass of sanctions between trade between Russia and Ukraine is being facilitated through South Ossetia, the succeeded piece of Georgia that Russia dominates. And that suggests to me that Putin may be in this for the long haul, and that our hope of realizing the resolution along the lines of the Minsk agreements seem farther than ever.
That's Robert Manning, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Also in the news, over the weekend, French police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse demonstrators in Paris who were upset about President Emmanuel Macron's fuel taxes. Reuters' Francis McGuire reports it was the second of the so-called Yellow Vest demonstrations.
This time, they converged on the French capital's iconic Champs-Élysées. Some clashed with police. About 3,000 officers were sent to prevent the demonstrators from reaching the president's Élysée Palace nearby. The protesters are opposed to taxes Macron introduced last year on diesel and gasoline, which are designed to encourage people to shift to more environmentally friendly transport. Alongside the tax, the government has also offered incentives to buy green or electric vehicles. The unrest is a dilemma for Macron, who casts himself as a champion against climate change, but has been derided as out of touch with common folk and is fighting a slump in popularity.
That is Reuters' Francis McGuire. VOA's Laurie London asked Paris-based journalist Catherine Field what the protesters are most upset about.
What they're particularly upset about is that French President Emmanuel Macron has brought in new taxes that will be levied on diesel fuel at the pump. Now, this means that diesel fuels will increase quite substantially over the next couple of months. There will be a tax of about 58% on each liter of diesel sold at the pump. Now, the president says he needs to do this because he's got to usher in this new ecological transition to the French nation, that they need to have these taxes to invest in renewable energies. Consumers are saying, hey, this is just too much tax on top of all the other taxes that you've come up with, and we can't all just dump our diesel cars or diesel tractors straight away. We need some sort of help from the government to be able to make this happen. So they've all come out on the street. I mean, this last weekend, we saw about 110,000 people out on the streets of France. Weekend before, there were more than twice that. And you really are seeing a great spread of the population. You're seeing low and middle-income earning families, mostly from rural areas. They're beyond their political differences, coming out onto the street and saying, look, it's hard enough making ends meet now, but you're bringing in this tax, which is, yes, it does mean that we might further down the road get cleaner forms of transport, but just at the moment, it's too much.
It sounded like there were about 8,000 people demonstrating on Saturday. What has been happening? It sounds like it's just a mess on what we know to be Paris's most iconic boulevard.
Yes, indeed. On the Champs-Élysées, from early in the morning to late at night, for more than 12 hours, you had running battles between protesters and police. Now, what had happened was early in the morning, the protesters, these so-called yellow vests who were protesting against these new taxes, they came onto the street. They were joined by what police are saying extreme right-wing disruptors, as they're called here in France, and they approached police, and there the trouble started. But in fact, it was more than that. We're talking about for more than 12 hours. You had this big stretch about 4 kilometers long from the Place de la Concorde right up the Champs-Élysées, right up to the Arc de Triomphe, just running battles. You had literally people picking up cobblestones and throwing it at the police. You had shop windows being smashed in. You had burning barricades. That went on for all that time. Police really did have trouble bringing it under control. And for a long period of the day, for several hours, there was concern that these demonstrators would make it to the presidential palace, which is just off the Champs-Élysées. Police managed to hold them back, but there were a few hours there when it was quite a concern. And really, just to see that there was this much damage done, and in lots of ways, a lot of anarchy, such a long period of time in this fabulous boulevard that goes straight through the center of Paris.
How do the majority of the French people feel about these protests and the protesters? Who are they more in agreement with?
Opinion polls show that more than 70% of French people agree with these protesters. They feel that these taxes on fuels are just a tax too far, and they feel that President Macron should start listening to the electorate that saw him into office just over a year and a half ago. The question is now, what will President Macron do after these demonstrations? He's due to make an address to the nation on Tuesday. He has said that he's not going to back down. He has made it quite clear that changing to cleaner forms of transport is one of the cornerstones of his administration. He's not going to back down on that. So it's difficult to see, now that he said this is it, these are the policies, and in the past he's pushed through other difficult policies, it's difficult to see how he can move back from this without losing too much faith when it comes to the protest.
Has he made any comments since the protest and the violence?
He has made many remarks. He's been away over the weekend up in Brussels at the European summit there. He says that he's very ashamed. He's disgusted by what he saw on the Champs-Élysées. In particular, he's come down on the side of the police and the gendarmes who are in the front line during those protests. He said he supports them. But also he says that he is not going to back down with these policies, that France has to bring in these new taxes, and they've got to fund these eco-friendly projects to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But at the end of the day, the big problem is going to be in the rural areas, where you have farmers who have, in many cases, sunk an awful lot of their capital into buying, say, a piece of kit like a tractor or something that is diesel-driven, and they just don't have the money to replace that particular piece of equipment, and they are going to be stung with these huge increases in the price of fuel.
Catherine Field is a Paris-based journalist. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A growing body of scientific evidence has suggested that our prehistoric ancestors were responsible for the extinction of a number of large mammal species in Africa. The research suggests that large mammals were becoming extinct at a faster rate than smaller animals, starting around the time when early humans began making and using stone tools and weapons. Among the large, now extinct animals that roamed Africa were gigantic woolly mammoths, along with a variety of early hippos, giraffes, and white and black rhinos. A new study from a group of U.S. scientists suggests that a long-term environmental change, such as dropping atmospheric carbon dioxide, and not our early human ancestors, were mostly responsible for the disappearance of these large, ancient, and mostly plant-eating mammal species beginning about 4.6 million years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. A historic mansion in the U.S. city of Detroit, owned by the late singing legend Aretha Franklin, has been sold just a couple of days ago. It's a huge home. It went for $300,000. It was built in 1927. You might remember that Aretha Franklin died of pancreatic cancer in August. She was in her Detroit riverfront apartment when all of that happened, and she was 76 years old. It's time now for a little something from the world of music. Mariah Carey is an American singer and songwriter, referred to as Songbird Supreme by Guinness World Records. She's noted for her 5-octave vocal range and the power of her voice. Carey became the first and only artist to have their first 5 singles reach number 1 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Vision of Love is one of them.
was all that you've given to me. I had a vision of love, and it was all that you've given me.
Following her marriage to Sony music head Tommy Mottola, Carrie became the label's highest-selling act. Her subsequent albums produced some of her most successful singles, including One Sweet Day, which Carrie sang with American R&B vocal group Boys to Men. Likely, Mariah Carey's most popular duet was sung with American singer, songwriter, and record producer Luther Vandross. Endless Love topped the charts.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's right.
My first love.
Billboard magazine named Mariah Carey the most successful artist of the 1990s, while the World Music Awards honored her as the world's best-selling record artist of the 90s. During that period, Hero, a huge fan favorite, was a big hit for Mariah Carey. Lyrically, the song is regarded as one of Carey's most inspirational and personal ballads, which went to the top of the Billboard Hot 100 chart.
So when you feel like hope is gone, look inside.
Mariah Carey's marriage to Tommy Mottola ended in 2000, and in 2008 she married actor Nick Cannon. They had twins, and in 2016 they divorced. Carey is an active Episcopalian, and in 2006 she said, "I feel like I've had endless second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth chances. It's by the grace of God I'm still here." Us are desperately searching for heroes in the world. This is a big inspiration, don't you think? Mariah Carey, superb voice. Speaking of voices, this is the Voice of America. We're grateful that you've tuned in to International Edition. Up next is the latest world news. We hope you'll stay with us for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Mariah Carey.
This is Today in History. On November 26, 1476, Vlad III, also known as Vlad the Impaler, the harsh ruler from whom the Dracula legend sprang, joined other leaders in defeating the ruler of the Principality of Wallachia. Vlad then became the ruler of the territory, which was located in modern-day Romania. In 1778, Captain James Cook became the first European to visit the Hawaiian island of Maui. On this day in 1703, Britain was experiencing what became known as the Great Storm, which tore across southern England. It left thousands dead on land and at sea. In 1789, U.S. President George Washington proclaimed November 26th as a day of public thanksgiving and prayer. In 1941, President Franklin Roosevelt signed a measure into law making the fourth Thursday of each November an official Thanksgiving holiday. On this day in 1842, one of America's preeminent educational institutions, Notre Dame University, was founded near South Bend, Indiana. In 1864, English mathematician and author the Reverend Charles Dodgson, known by the pseudonym Lewis Carroll, presented a handwritten manuscript titled Alice's Adventures in Wonderland to the young girl who inspired it, Alice Liddell. The story, known famously as Alice in Wonderland, tells the story of a girl named Alice who falls down a rabbit hole into a world of fantasy. It was published the next year and remains a classic in children's literature. In 1883, American preacher, abolitionist, and women's rights advocate Sojourner Truth died in Battle Creek, Michigan at the age of 86. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.